Hey, Art of Power listeners. I just wanted you to know that this episode may be inappropriate for some of you. We discuss suicide, rape, and drug addiction. Heavy topics, even though we discuss them sometimes in lighthearted ways.
Every comedian has one elemental joke that they're spending a lifetime retelling. So my elemental joke is, I don't belong here.
Margaret Cho, an elder stateswoman in comedy and pathbreaker. She began touring the stand-up circuit as a teenager, dropped out of school, and at age 23, created the very first TV sitcom about an Asian American family. It was an adventure with many missteps.
I was missing the historical context, the social, political arena, the invisibility that Asian Americans were dealing with. When you're dealing with invisibility, it's really hard to put words to it because you don't even know that you're there. You don't even know that you're invisible.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Art of Power. I'm Aarti Shahani. Today, American comedy icon, feminist, and queer grandmother of sorts, Margaret Cho, deconstructs the past as both survivor and historian, and also inspiration to so many Asian American entertainers. We discuss the unique opportunity she stumbled upon as a young person of color in Hollywood, how she saw the situation back then, and how she sees it today.
I missed the young, beautiful girl that I was, and I can't believe I didn't see it.
She also gives us a comedy mini masterclass. So if you want to get better at being funny, or just understand why no one laughs at your jokes, stick around. Margaret Cho starred in the first Asian American sitcom on network TV called All American Girl. It debuted in 1994, and Margaret played a fictional version of herself, Margaret Kim, the rebellious daughter of Korean immigrant parents, living in a multi-generational home in San Francisco.
Grandma, what are you still doing up?
Oh, I have trouble sleeping.
You know that's pornography.
Free your willy. It's good.
And it bombed.
Mm-hmm.
Was it fated to do that?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of elements regarding the failure of that show. Mm-hmm. And after the show went off the air, we didn't see another Asian American family for almost 20 years.
Yeah, it's really stunning to me how long it took to get back on network TV in this country.
Yes.
And to deconstruct it a little bit then, Margaret, could you in a nutshell describe what do you think went wrong?
Well, I think what went wrong was I wasn't prepared as an artist. And immediately when the show was canceled, my thought was I didn't lose enough weight. Because that was such a pressing point of my appearance on television was conditional on how much weight I was able to lose before the show premiered.
I see. They told you you're not thin enough to play yourself, so you got to get thinner.
Yes. Uh-huh. I got to get thinner. And this was the era of the shows that were out were Friends, premiered the same season. You know, it was supposed to be about sort of regular girls.
With eating
but
disorders.
Of course, they were so thin. And I think people don't even acknowledge that. Feminism had just started to emerge as a very normal part of society. But with that feminism, you were put into this arena of you have to be thin in order to be feminist. Like, there's like, we'll accept your feminism. We'll accept your revolution if you fit into our uniform.
And it's a size zero.
Yeah. That was the beginning of that. I mean, of course, it had existed for a long time. But it's like, you know, Kate Moss was sort of the icon of what to look like.
An emaciated supermodel.
Oh, emaciated yeah. supermodel. But even the Riot Girls, our feminist role models, were also kind of put to that picture of how to look, how to be. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, it's a confusing time in terms of feminism, and body positivity didn't exist.
And so when your show wasn't doing well, you instantly took it as, I didn't lose enough weight.
Absolutely. That was the only thing that I had focused on.
And so what were you missing that was there?
I was missing the historical context, the social, political arena, the invisibility that Asian Americans were dealing with. When you're dealing with invisibility, it's really hard to put words to it because you don't even know that you're there. You don't even know that you're invisible. Mm-hmm. So it's a very strange place to try to emerge from. Even like the tabloids at the time would publish diets that I supposedly endorsed. They would write totally fictionalized articles about how I had lost weight, which I didn't even know where this comes from. But
that was the entire focus that society was mirroring to you and you mirroring back.
Yes.
And so in retrospect, like if you were coaching young Margaret Cho, like, hey, girl, you're looking at the wrong thing. Stop looking in the mirror.
Yes.
What would you have pointed out as this is what she needed to see?
Well, how beautiful I was, because I missed that.
Hell yeah.
I missed the young, beautiful girl that I was. And I can't believe I didn't see it. Because it's gone. And, you know, I definitely embrace
it's not gone,
a new kind of
but okay.
Well, it's, I embrace a new kind of beauty that I inhabit fully. But when I was young, I could have ruled the world, and I didn't know. I just didn't see my own beauty. I didn't embrace my own loveliness. I couldn't stand pictures of myself, so I just didn't take them. There's relatively few pictures that I took by myself that I'm very sad to have missed.
You had a mentor and guide, I believe an agent back then at the time, a woman named Gail. And she's the person who came to you one day before your show, All American Girl, launched. And she told you politely, but directly, hey, Margaret, I hate to tell you this. I'm not skinny myself, but you got to be more skinny to play you.
Yes.
You listened. You went on crazy diets. Mm-hmm. You threw yourself into kidney failure because you were trying so aggressively to lose weight. What would have happened if you said no? If you were like, nah, this is how I look?
I think it would have been much more pleasant for me, probably, but maybe unpleasant in other ways. You know, and I felt bad for Gail because, you know, she was sort of saddled with the task because she was woman, because she was closest to me. But I think it's hard, you know, like I don't know. Like I didn't have the strength. I didn't have the power that I perceived all these other people having power. But really, it's like, you know, when somebody's painting a portrait of you, you have to stay still and pose. You can't sort of control your own image, you know? And that's what I was thinking I had to do, was control my own image somehow. And that wasn't the way to power.
Could you have flexed? Could you have exercised agency in ways that you simply didn't because you felt you couldn't?
I don't know. I mean, I could have possibly rebelled against it in the way that I rebelled against any kind of convention, being a stand-up comedian. But I was in such a different world. Television was so different from stand-up comedy. So I just didn't have the confidence.
That is really what struck me, you having such in your comedy this rebellious, no holds barred, here is who I am. Holy crap, is this Asian American young woman really saying these things in public?
Like, I was with this guy that was too long. It's really long, really skinny and really long, really long. I was like, what? What are you gonna check my oil with that thing? What? What? Make a balloon animal?
I was wondering about the why was it in stand-up you could be so, some would say, unhinged or just raw yourself. But in that work, facing a TV deal in a network, the walls went up.
I just didn't understand that the stage is a stage and it doesn't matter where you are. You can still be the same. Like I thought, because I'm going to television, this has to be a whole new world, that I have to use these interpreters somehow, that I couldn't speak the language of executives, and that I needed somebody, male, cis, white, to guide me, which was essentially wrong. I mean, they could see in me a different way for them to do what they were doing. Because, you know, Seinfeld was very popular. Home Improvement was very popular. They were achieving all of these incredible goals with stand-up comedians at the helm. And so they wanted to do a different take on that, which was with me. It's weird, though, because I had so much high hopes for their input. But one of them ended up murdering his wife and putting her in the closet for a month until she had partially mummified.
Oh, my God.
That's J.J. Paulson. He had a deal. He was one of the producers of my show. And he went on to do Bill Cosby's show. The new one, not the Cosby show, but the second one in New York. And eventually left that and killed his wife.
Wow.
And
so you were trusting the wrong people.
I was trusting the wrong. I mean, okay. It's not funny.
No. But actually, you have to laugh.
You have to laugh, or else you would just like, you can't, like, but the people I was putting my trust in were people like, that were literal murderers.
Right.
Not figurative, not metaphorical, literal murderers. It's so horrifying. But at the same time, that's the power of whiteness. That's the power of maleness. It's the power of heterosexuality. You know, that this idea that the cis white male author is going to write you into power. That's not the case.
He's going to teach you to be you for America.
Yes. Yes.
This man Margaret is talking about, J.J. Paulson, he was a writer and an executive story editor on her show, and he was later sentenced to 26 years in prison for voluntary manslaughter. Margaret, who's won Grammys for her comedy albums, wrote a song about him.
Well, I'm sorry I hit you with that brick. At least your death was fairly quick. And I hope you weren't in too much pain. I guess I'm criminally insane.
Back in the mid-1990s, the Asian American reaction to All American Girl was not pretty. Margaret said the show was poorly received, particularly among the elders.
There was this paranoia about being perceived as too American, that we had lost our identity somehow in Americanness. And it's a generational thing. Like the generation that were rebelling against this were people who had come to America, struggled with unimaginable racism, and yet held on to their identity for themselves, and they wanted to sort of exclude the rest of the world in a sense.
So the classic like immigrant protectiveness of the pure self, and here this young woman is corrupting it on TV.
Right. And being a woman, because Koreans are such a patriarchal culture. You know, the fact that I was a woman, the fact that I was very queer already, very, very sexual, not thin, not educated, and not speaking Korean.
Which you speak fluently.
Which I do actually do now. It's taken many Korean dramas and lots of K-pop. Back then, it was really Koreans trying to keep themselves insulated from the violence, the racism, the fear of being the other and the other coming in. And so Asian American identity was very different. And the April before the show had premiered, it was a lot of times the first times Koreans had seen themselves on television, which was during the LA riots. So they were incredibly paranoid and protective over their own image. Mm-hmm. The arena of Asianness in entertainment was that. It was Korean store owners in the film Do the Right Thing, which is Spike Lee's film. So there was a lot of things that we were sort of dealing with underneath it all. The emergence of North Korea as a nuclear entity, mm-hmm. which is a very subtle part of the bias against us at the network.
Interesting. But the sense of distrust should be there because...
Yeah, okay. The sense of distrust, the sense of fear around, can we see an Asian American family right now? And so there was a lot of hesitation to embrace my emergence as a comedian and also this television show. But the younger people really responded to it because younger people who were encouraged to go into careers that they didn't want to be in, mm-hmm. who never saw themselves on television, were avidly consuming my comedy, my appearances on television, because this was this lifeline. Like, oh, I could do something else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a tough situation you were in. How old were you?
24. This all happened between the ages of... 23 and 25.
Right.
So I really didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah. Well, you know, you did what you could with what you knew. When your show got canceled, you went into years of highly self-destructive alcoholism, drug addiction, mm-hmm. and something that happened in that period of time is you also accidentally got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
You describe in your first book, I'm the One That I Want, which is a great title.
Oh, thank you.
You describe a completely crazy moment when you've gone to the abortion clinic and the abortion doctor, who's wearing latex gloves and going into your vagina,
yes.
begins to give you feedback on your canceled show and your creative journey.
Is it? Yeah, he is like, you know, I think that if you decide to go back into television again, that you should lobby to have more creative control. And I'm like, that's fine, but could you just kill my baby? It's funny now to think about, like, especially in the scope of, like, where we are now in terms of abortion and I wouldn't say kill my baby now because I don't think of it as a baby. And I don't think of it as killing anything, actually.
I'm going to pin that at the side because really the thing I'm interested about here is that strange thing. I mean, did you feel like, why is the universe speaking to me through this rando?
Yeah, it was a kind of thing of like, everybody's got to have input on this because it became such a huge issue and I'm not going to be able to escape it. No matter how much I try to drink it away or drug it away. And, you know, I actually, at that point, became sober for several years and started to be much more addicted to stand-up comedy, which really helped me out of that. Although my problems with drugs and alcohol, which I thought had emerged strictly because of my own failures in show business, really wasn't the case. I think addiction and alcoholism is definitely deep in my family, generations of it. But it's been so secretive because there's so much shame around mental illness in Korean culture. I mean, in all cultures, but in Asian culture in particular, there's so much secrecy and shame around it.
How have you been able to stay sober for 6 years now? What switch flipped that helped you to do that?
Oh, I just want to live. And also, like, I realized that my worth is not my work. My worth is not my, what I look like or what anything sort of external is. My worth is how I feel inside. And so, focusing on that has really helped me. Like, I just have another outlook on life. And, like, I would like to see it through. I would like to live more so that I can tell more jokes and so that I can laugh more.
You wanted to live.
Yeah, which is new. That's like a new... That's a new thing to come to at 52.
With All American Girl, just again, to sort of force a loop closure here, what do you think the show did for Asian Americans in this country?
Oh, I think it really inspired an entire generation of young artists to force the idea of being seen, to allow them to have permission to be seen, and to give them the possibility of being seen. So there's a lot of people that I can say were directly influenced just by that, whether it's John Cho, you know, Awkwafina.
For me, I had one glimpse of representation when I was young. That was channel surfing and catching Margaret Cho on Comedy Central.
Or Bowen Yang or Joel Kim Booster or Ali Wong, Hari Kondabolu.
Margaret Cho, as the child of immigrants, as, you know, like me being the first generation born in this country, it hit. Like, this is somebody who is so powerful.
So many amazing artists saw that and said, I can see myself. I can be seen. And I will do that. And so they've gone on to achieve incredible things, whether that's Crazy Rich Asians, whether that's Shang-Chi, whether that's, you know, Nora is Awkwafina from Queens, whether that's Bowen, you know, getting an Emmy nomination, whether that's the new movie Fire Island that we just finished.
It's the progress you're
seeing. It's the progress, and it's every day. It's Steven or Yoon being nominated for Academy Award. It's Yoon winning.
And the Oscar goes to Jo Jung Yoon.
It's Nomadland.
Chloe Zhao, Nomadland.
It's everything, you know. So to me, all of these I own as my achievements, which is the best.
That's the benefit of being first. You may not have done it perfect, but you own it. What comes
next. But it's mine. Like, I, you know, like, I'm like, oh, I did that. Like, I really am very satisfied. So it's a great thing to be able to witness. And, you know, I'm glad I didn't OD to be around to see it.
Like, literally, yeah.
Yeah, because I could have many times. And so it's like a miracle that I'm able to say, well, I kind of did something good. So that is really amazing.
Is representing the Asian American community your responsibility?
I don't know. I think it's everybody's responsibility who's part of it.
No, but I mean part of yours. I mean, I guess you didn't necessarily go into comedy being like, hey, I'm going to speak for the community. But do you now see, oh, yeah, I speak for the community?
Yeah, you have to, especially with my queerness, with my age. I am kind of a queer grandmother of sorts, and I have a lot of things that I still need to learn, but I also am very impressed by the way that young people have embraced their identities, embraced the idea of, like, pronouns. Now everybody's talking about gender in a way that was never possible before. And that's, I think, really exciting and new. And so I think, like, as a feminist, as an Asian American woman, as a single woman in her 50s, very happy, it's important to talk about the joy of life as opposed to, like, the way that we frame spinsterhood in society, especially for Asian women, has been so negative.
It's like, ah.
I love it. I love having a bunch of animals. I have so many cats that is like the best. And like the whole idea of like crazy cat lady is the best existence of all.
I love it. We're going to repeat. I love spinsterhood.
I love spinsterhood because it allows me to dance like a spinster. I'm spinning. Like, I'm spinning in a beautiful, gorgeous way. And, like, we want to trap women into this idea that you have to be partnered to be happy, that you have to have children and have grandchildren. And yet we don't allow women agency to choose their own lives. Like, every time I've shared space with anybody else, I've been miserable. And finally, like, I realized over a lifetime of very difficult partnerships that I'm actually better as a solo act.
was thinking about, why do I have such an emotional reaction to you? Like the fact of Margaret Cho. And for me, it's probably because you're an outspoken woman of color who's also very clearly a feminist. I'm not so sure it's the Asian American thing, because I don't really think that there's any Asian American solidarity. Like, I wish there was. I don't think there is. Like, I think, for example, the brown-yellow divide is real. You know, like, I'm the brown, you're the yellow. And it's not like we're really identifying with each other's stories deeply. And so I guess I just sort of, you know, I ask you about your experience in building Asian American identity and power and whatnot. And even as I ask all that stuff, part of me feels like I'm building a conversation on something I fundamentally feel is a fallacy.
I wonder what that is about. Like, I think it's like, for me, like, Koreanness, it's a very combative identity because we're a country that's been so invaded. And we're, over time, my family's had different names. Like, my family is, like, known traitors. Like, we pretended to be Japanese. We took on a Japanese name.
Oh, okay. To survive back home.
To survive. Okay. And survived being shunned by our Korean community because my grandfather had a job as a Japanese train conductor and just embraced Japanese culture. He, up until his death, was far more comfortable speaking Japanese, far more comfortable reading Japanese.
So is it basically that you think that, like, the whole notion of solidarity and shared identity is something that intergenerationally we fought in order to survive in a colonial warfare context? So we've been practicing not having solidarity for so long, it's hard to have it here.
Yes. And then so when it's like the South Asian, East Asian, like, divide, we've got to come together. Like, we don't have the luxury of separating ourselves anymore from other Asian communities. We just don't. This is like a big thing that's happened this week is there's a Korean drama out that just came out with the biggest stars called The Squid Game. And one of the stars is Pakistani. He's a Pakistani Korean. And it's a very big deal to show solidarity between South and East Asian communities coming together in this show. Like, it's very deep. And so when Korea is acknowledging it, you know it's very big. It's like, we have to do it.
After the break, as a teen, Margaret Cho worked as a phone sex operator, specifically for callers new to America.
And we would read out these sort of, like, sensual monologues that had very simple sentence structure that could be understood by somebody who was just learning English. I am a sexy girl. My name is Susan. I have blonde hair and blue eyes.
This is Art of Power. I'm Aarti Shahani. Hey folks, your host Aarti Shahani here. We have decided to start, drumroll, a newsletter for the Art of Power community. An exclusive place for invites and access to myself as well as guests featured on the show. Subscribe at wbez.org/AOP newsletter.
So I grew up and would be at the bookstore. You know, in this, like, brief time, like, it's probably, like, nine, and seeing guys dressed up in, like, cowboy outfits and policeman outfits and coming from their hometowns, all coming together, rolling racks of gay romance novels with, like, a young man next to a river with, like, jean shorts and a blue tank top, and they'd be, like, Cobalt would be the title. It was all color-based. Blue Boy and Cobalt.
Margaret Cho's parents, who migrated from Korea in 1964, tried to do what a lot of immigrant families do, build an all-American life. They did it, though, not by moving to the suburbs, but by running a gay bookstore in San Francisco.
They owned a gay bookstore called Paperback Traffic. They purchased in 1976 and sort of began operations in 1977. Around the same time, Harvey Milk was coming into quite a lot of power. And this is a very exciting time in gay politics and San Francisco politics because it was after Harvey Milk and before AIDS. Very brief period of time where you had the sense that, like, being gay was it.
Margaret loved hanging out at the gay bookstore. Her parents encouraged it.
My parents really having a sense of, like, needing to push me off into the company of gay men because they really know what art is. They know what music to listen to. They know what you should be wearing, what you should be saying, what you should be doing. So they pushed me into this arena of culture.
They were like, these guys are going to teach you to be American and cultured.
And highfalutin, you know, like they're going to give me an overview of class.
Like the original Queer Eye.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like 70s Queer Eye.
When do you then identify as queer?
I think it was before I knew what it meant because I was always very attached to my female friends, always had crushes on other girls, always had a sense of immense suffering around female relationships. With boys, I would just beat them up.
And so basically you're saying you basically always knew you were queer?
I think so. I just didn't have a name for it. And I feel like that's almost like why my parents pushed me into these relationships with gay men, because maybe they would be able to understand something that my parents couldn't.
Oh, so do you think your parents actually had a sense before you could verbalize it of like, oh, our daughter is queer?
Yes.
And these, oh, interesting.
And these men will know more about it than we do because we can't possibly begin to understand how to make this right for her. Also, my father loves male attention because South Korea's greatest export is male beauty. And, and he's very handsome. Okay. And so he doesn't really care about female attention, but he revels in male attention because men really know what's gorgeous. So he all of the guys that work for my dad were in love with him, and they would paint portraits of him that are still hanging in his home today.
So it's either his own vanity and or compassion for his daughter.
I think it's a combination.
As a teenager, I believe you were like 15 years old, you worked as a phone sex operator.
Yes.
Specifically for callers who wanted to learn English and jerk off at the same time.
Yes.
explain that very particular niche.
So my friend Jerry, who recently passed away, she was like the friend that could get you in all the trouble. And she got us this job because we were both working at FAO Schwartz, which is the big toy store. And she was the court jester and I was the Raggedy Ann. And then she got another job at the phone sex operating place. We were like 15. And so first we started in this big room with cubicles where all these women were sitting and talking on the phone, you know, making sounds with, you know, give me that ass, show me that ass, like slapping on like headsets, slapping. I was terrible at it, but we sounded white. So they brought us to the recording booth at the end of the cubicles. And we would read out these sort of like sensual monologues that had very simple sentence structure that could be understood by somebody who was just learning English. So it was, I am a sexy girl. My name is Susan. I have blonde hair and blue eyes.
It's more interesting for some than Scott can run.
Yes.
Scott is a dog. Got it.
Yes.
Okay.
It was very simple, very structured English, but would end in some kind of heavy breathing.
Why is that the job you were motivated to do?
Well, I was trying to do whatever I could to avoid getting a, you know, a job that was stuck me into a schedule because I wanted to do stand-up comedy.
You wanted flexibility.
Yes.
Margaret Cho understands comedy in a way most of us do not, but would like to. I asked asked her to give us a mini masterclass. And her responses are brilliant, as you're about to see, though also in some places, it's quite hard to listen to. She has jokes about both suicide and rape.
Comedy is the unexpected breath from the unexpected thought. So comedians really are the master of a misdirected idea. You'll sort of think you're coming along one way and then something else will come in. So that's what a comedian will do, is take you into a channel of thinking you weren't prepared to go into, which causes an unexpected breath. So that's a laugh, is mm-hmm. surprise. Mm-hmm. And so a comedian, it's almost like you're kind of like an aerobics instructor or a yoga teacher. You're like mm-hmm. causing somebody to breathe unexpectedly. That's mm-hmm. basically the breakdown of what a comedian does.
Making people take the unexpected breath. Yes. Interesting.
Part of it, too, is that every comedian has one elemental joke that they're spending a lifetime retelling. So my elemental joke is, I don't belong here. And so every joke that I tell has some element of I don't belong here, and that's what I'm kind of disseminating. Like somebody like Jerry Seinfeld's...
I was literally just going to ask you, what's his?
His elemental joke is, why? So every joke he tells has some element of why. Like he's a questioning kind of comedian. So everything he does is like a query into what is this? Why is this going on? Why?
Right, right. What makes a joke a good joke?
I think the more unexpected the thought. So it's, this is probably the darkest joke that I have told. Is when I was really in the depths of drug addiction, and I actually hung myself from my shower curtain rod. I hung myself, and as I was hanging, the shower curtain rod started bending. And I was like, oh shit, I'm too fat to kill myself. I gotta get down. I'll try again when I reach my goal weight, which means I'm never gonna kill myself because I'm never gonna reach my goal weight. So that's an example of, in a very literal, I'm not supposed to be here. But I am.
That's dark.
Yeah, it's dark, but it's also like the unexpected thought of like, it's actually very life-affirming. It's like, well, I can't do it.
I can't commit suicide because I got to lose weight.
I'm
first.
Never going to do
it. Wow. And you actually had that thought when you were when you were attempting to take your own life?
Yes. And it was something that made me laugh. Like, I actually laughed out loud.
And so literally your sense of humor saved your life in that
moment. Yeah. And it does all the time, you know, because when you can find that optimism, which for me is my humor, it's like my way of surprising myself with my thinking, then I can keep going. And sometimes when I tell that joke, people get super upset because they're stuck on, you didn't give me a trigger warning. You know, like there's a trigger warning. But the idea is like, I can't give you a trigger warning because the whole point of it is just to sort of blast this truth. So yeah, it's just to disarm you.
There is a time where you told some very dark jokes and it did not go well.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically around rape.
Yes.
You have been repeatedly sexually assaulted.
Yes.
Starting as a child.
Yes.
Through your young adult life.
Yes. And I think that's really hard for people to laugh about. I mean, it's hard for anybody to laugh at any of that kind of suffering. But at the same time, you have to be able to talk about it in a way that motivates you to heal. You know, when you expose wounds to the air, they'll heal. So the real thing is to be able to skillfully detonate the bomb without actually bombing. You know, it's a very...
without you bombing.
Yeah. It's a very delicate sort of procedure with tweezers and a stethoscope.
Can we deconstruct the time that you bombed with, I'm calling it the rape set. I don't know what else to call it.
It is a comedy show. It is not supposed to be a rape
show. I did a show, and it was in a club that I was, like, not prepared to talk so openly about these rape jokes. I was like the joke is, I was raped by a relative when I was very young, and I told my mother about it, and she said, oh yeah, he already raped your aunt, so you're not special. So that's like, that's, to me, it's really funny. But it's right, really upsetting right. to people right. to hear.
I could see it as both, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So when people got upset about it, I got upset. I got defensive and angry.
Oh, because you delivered it and it wasn't funny. People shut down.
I delivered it wasn't funny. People shut down. And then I wasn't able to recover. And I just started to, like, really kind of pound them with, why didn't you get that? You should have gotten that. I don't understand what's happening. Like, angry. And think about it. It's like, if I'm doing poorly as a comedian, if you don't like me, I'm going to make you hate me. Because mm-hmm. I'm such a rageful comic sometimes. Like, mm-hmm. I just, if it's not going well, like, I'll get really angry and just keep going.
No, you will never get a cent of the money back that you paid.
True. Like, you know, so it was a very combative situation.
You all suck.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it wasn't the right attitude to take. So then it went terribly.
So you basically bomb. You say you get angry at them. And then what happens? Do you just sort of walk out in a fit? Or what happened that night?
Oh, I walked out. I think it was covered by TMZ. I felt bad because the club got a lot of complaints, and it's a club that's owned by a comedian. Mm. That's such a noble thing for a comedian to own a club. Mm. It's very difficult. It was going to put them out of a lot of money because they were competing people asking for money back.
And refunds. Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very tough thing. And I was in Hong Kong, and Jerry Seinfeld called me and asked me to appear on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And then we talked about it on the show.
Where are you going next?
That one show that I bombed at, I want to go back and do a free makeup show and invite all the people who are upset and have a...
That's a great idea.
And then decided together to go back and do a show at the same club with him kind of mediating, sort of being therapist and counsel.
Mm. Using also his white male privilege, I would imagine, in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also his fame mm-hmm. and his elemental questioning joke of why. And his real long relationship with me. Because we've been friends for many, many years, since the 80s.
And so when you step back into the same club now with your wingman, Jerry Seinfeld, what shifts that you turn a bad joke into a good joke?
First, the experience of inviting an audience back and that I care enough about their opinion to hear them speak about it.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you all. You were all here the night that Margaret had the show that went awry.
Their opportunity to get to see him, he's one of the biggest comedian, if not the biggest comedian of all time, and to be able to redo a show for them that shows my respect for the audience and my respect for the art form, which I think is a unique opportunity, but also something that I'm really grateful to get to do. I mean, I think it's really, it's sort of a once in a lifetime thing.
So it's always a little edgy. Somebody yells out, somebody turns their back. It's not hard to lose it. And you're exhausted, sub sandwich, Korean-American threatened by white people.
I didn't do my job, and so that's why I wanted to come back and say that I was sorry.
She had the guts to come back to talk about
Absolutely.
It. All right, well, we would like to perform a show for you.
Mm. And so between take one and take two, what did you learn from that?
I think that you can go back and then you can sort of redo something that didn't sit right. And that for me is the ultimate unexpected thought, that you can actually go back and retell a story and have a better outcome.
This power to redo that you've referred to actually a few times in our conversation, is that something you always realized you had the power to do, the power to redo, or did you finally realize it?
I think I finally realized it. I think I finally realized that reinvention is another tool that you can use in life. Like, things don't have to be so final and complete. Like, this doesn't have to go in your permanent record. That was always the threat when I was in school. This is going on your permanent record. But the record of permanence doesn't have to be so permanent.
My lessons from Margaret Cho. One, don't just look in the mirror. When you fail or succeed, you have a tendency to think it's all about what you did. Well, the environment, the context, may be more relevant. Scan it. Two, don't tie your worth as a human to your success. The joy of achievement disappears when you fail, and you may not know how to get it back. Embrace your inherent value. Three, in those rare moments when you get to demonstrate your true potential, don't falter and cave to what the old guard is saying. Even when they look like authority figures, for example, a white man in a suit, they don't always know better. This episode of Art of Power was produced by Justin Bull, Paloma Moreno Jimenez, Hina Srivastava, and me, Arthi Shahani. Our executive producer is Kevin Dawson. If this episode landed for you, broke your brain, moved your heart, hit subscribe. Leave a written review on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends and family. And let me know what you think directly on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Arthi411. A-A-R-T-I 411. All right, see you next week.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.